This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Good afternoon, history lovers and picnic campers, and welcome to the first of two History Ireland Hedge Schools with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Now, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dan Mulhall, not former US ambassador, he stresses, former Irish ambassador to the US, just to make that absolutely clear. Myself and Dan go back a long time. Dan's been writing articles for History Ireland magazine for the last 25 years. And alongside that, he managed to find time to dabble in a little bit of diplomacy, you know, a case of never letting your job interfere with your work. Anyway, just before I move on to the topic in question, just to give a bit of background on Dan, he was ambassador to Malaysia from 2001. And of course, a few years later, they had that the tsunami broke out. Then he was in Germany in 2009. Then you had the financial crisis. Then he was in the UK for Brexit. And then he was signed to... Dan, is there a pattern here?
Yes.
you're obviously...
I'm trouble wherever I go.
Right. Okay, now, Dan's brief here, an easy one, making sense of Trump's America. So, Dan, the first question I want to ask you, I mean, you became ambassador to Washington in 2017, just as Trump came in his first presidency. Just before we talk about the politics, just on a personal level, what was he like? I mean, you must have met him.
Yeah, quite a few times. I presented credentials to him in September of 2017 in the Oval Office, and I had taken the precaution of playing a round of golf at Doon Beg the week before I moved to Washington, which meant that I had a good talking point for the president, because he is very proud of his and keen on his experience of being a property owner and a golf course owner in the west of Ireland, in County Clare. So that was a good entree with him. And we had a very pleasant conversation. In fact, it was my wife Greta's birthday that day. And he was told about this, and he insisted on her coming in and standing between myself and himself and having the photograph taken. He said, they'll give out to me for this because I'm supposed to be in the middle, but it's your birthday, so you should stand in the middle instead. So he's quite a charmer. You know, he's a TV personality. He's a guy who's been involved in the real estate business in New York for so long. So he is, you know, that kind of person. Now, frankly, I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him. Because during my time in Washington, the British ambassador had to actually leave his post because a report he sent back to London, a confidential report analyzing the Trump presidency, was leaked to the media. And when Trump got a hold of this, he started going after the ambassador in a very determined way, and the ambassador had to step down and returned to London. He's now a member of the House of Lords, so he got a little compensation prize for his trouble. But so yeah, look, I mean, he is essentially a TV personality. He can be charming, but he also has a pretty tough side to him, and that is probably developed during his time in the cutthroat world of the New York property scene.
Now, you also met him in Mar-a-Lago.
Yes,
what was that like?
Well, I mean, I met him in Mar-a-Lago, and what I was impressed by there was that he remembered a conversation we had before, or the previous time we met, about the undocumented Irish people who went there and didn't have the right to live in America and were now in danger of being sent home or whatever. And he remembered that conversation. And he said to me, what happened with those people? So I told him that we had managed to get a bill through Congress that would have given 5,000 visas to Irish people, which wouldn't have completely solved the undocumented problem, but it would have gone some way towards solving it. It would have been a positive step in the right direction. And he said, what happened? I said, well, it went through the House of Representatives unanimously. He said, oh, that's great. I said, it was blocked in the Senate by a single senator. He said, who was that? I said, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. He said, Tom's a great friend of mine. I'll talk to him about it this evening. So anyway, he went away. First of all, he said to me, it was like a photograph. So I had to give my camera, my phone, to our host, who was a member of Mar-a-Lago, who took a photograph of myself and Greta standing beside Donald Trump and Melania. Both of them dwarfed us. I'm not that small, but when you stand beside Donald Trump and Melania, you know, you look pretty small in the photograph. So anyway, have that photograph. But then an hour and a half later, he was coming back from his dinner and he hit me on the shoulder and said, I'll talk to Tom for you. Right. So he's a transactional politician, right?
Yeah.
But obviously, he's a different kind of person now from what he was when I knew him in those days. The first Trump presidency, he was like chalk and cheese to the current one. You know, at that time, he was a bit of a, he was a bit of a novice. He didn't really understand, I think, the dynamics of politics. He's in a he's a very different proposition this time around.
Do you think he expected to be elected in 2016?
No.
Okay.
I mean, he had what someone described to me as a mom and pop operation for his campaign. It was essentially the family and a few others. He had hardly anybody. Most campaigns are much bigger than that. So when he became the nominee, I think he was as surprised as anybody else. I don't think he expected a win because, you know, on the face of it, Hillary Clinton was an extremely well-qualified candidate. She'd been in the White House as First Lady. She'd been Senator for New York. She'd been Secretary of State. She was one of the best-equipped people ever to stand for the presidency. And yet he beat her. So I don't think they really expected. I don't think they were ready for... For example, a friend of mine ended up helping to run the transition team because he discovered they didn't have any transition team in place. I mean, normally, if you're running for president of the U.S., about a year before the election, you actually set up a transition team, you know, in case you win the election. As soon as you become a candidate, you're actually given money by the American state to run a transition team so that you're ready to move into the White House on day one with a team of people to support you. And apparently, 2016, there was no transition team. So it was all had to be put together at breakneck speed. This time they had 4 years to prepare themselves and they did it very thoroughly. And that's why we're now seeing a very activist presidency. By the way, while I'm at it, I see Arthur O'Leary here of the Election Commission. He asked me to tell everyone to register to vote in our presidential election in November of this year.
Yeah, are you going to stand, Dan?
No, I'm not. No.
Anyone here going to stand? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to stand now.
We're desperately looking for candidates here for this election. Just before we move on to the second administration of Dan, I mean, what was it like then? I mean, I presume it was total chaos in Washington.
Well, I remember we had monthly EU ambassadors meetings, right? We would sit around the table in the EU ambassador's residence. He was actually an Irishman, David O'Sullivan, a friend of mine from when I started in foreign affairs back in the 70s. And somebody once described those meetings as collective psychotherapy because it looked as if everything was going down the plug hole. You know, the whole thing was collapsing. I mean, you know, every time we met, there was a new development and every development was alarming. There were very few positive things happening. We were sort of looking at a thing that we'd never seen before. Nobody had ever seen a presidency like this. A presidency that was basically being conducted on social media rather than in the normal way. The difference between that presidency and the predecessors, you know, say Clinton or Bush, George W. Bush or Reagan or anyone like that, was that with the Reagan presidency, the Bush presidency, the Clinton presidency, you could talk to the officials and you could get a strong sense of what was going to happen. You know, they could predict to you, but they would admit to you at that time that the president really would decide, and they weren't convinced as to how he would decide to move. You know, they couldn't predict what his decision would be. And that's very unusual, and that's very alarming for diplomats, because part of the job of a diplomat is to try and predict the future, trying to tell your government in advance, look, this is what's coming down the tracks. And we really didn't know at that stage, because I would wake up every morning and I would check Donald Trump's Twitter account to see what he tweeted about overnight and had he said anything that might be troublesome from an Irish point of view or from a European Union point of view. So, yeah, it was a difficult time, but I would say nothing like as difficult as it has been over the last 8 months. Yeah.
Now, just to remind the audience here, you're at the History Ireland Head School. You are meant to participate, so we do have a radio mic here. So if people want to come into the conversation at any stage, just put your hand up and you can ask Dan a few difficult questions. I mean, did anyone see this coming, Dan? I mean, I'm assuming that the Irish embassy, like any embassy, will have its feelers in society,
yeah.
You know. I mean, like, what has led to this? Because this is what I want to look at. which the title of this discussion is Trump's America, not Trump himself necessarily, no, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, did anyone see this coming?
Short answer is no. No, I mean, if you, Greta and I traveled, we visited all 50 states during our time, during our 6 years in America. And when you go outside the big cities, you do see a level of deprivation that would be different from what you find in Ireland or in most European countries. There's a lot of parts of the United States that are very definitely almost like places that time forgot, where, you know, the world has moved on. You go to the cities like New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, all the big cities have very dynamic economies, but you go to smaller towns and they feel like a bit of a wasteland. So I guess Trump managed to tap into the resentment of people in those places that felt they had been overlooked, ignored, and more or less looked down upon by the elite. And I could see very clear similarities between the two. Because if you look at where Trump won the 2016 election, it was what they call the Rust Belt. He won Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. These are places where there's a lot of that kind of post-industrial decline, places that haven't found a new momentum for themselves, that feel like they've been left behind by this kind of globalized economy that, you know, makes sense for people in LA and New York, but doesn't make sense for people in Columbus, Ohio, places like that. So they were the people who voted in numbers for Donald Trump and who turned the election in his favor. Because in America, it's always 4 or 5 states that determine the outcome of the election. Most of the states, you could guarantee in advance who's going to win that state. You can't guarantee Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. So he won those states because of the resentment that people in those places felt about what had happened the previous 20 or 30 years with the globalization of the economy. And so, you know, and if you look at Brexit basically was won in the formerly great industrial towns of the north of England, which voted 70% for Brexit. London, which is a success story, benefits from the globalized international economy. London voted 75-80% for Remain. So the same dichotomy exists in the United States as existed in Britain, and which gave rise to the Brexit referendum. So, you know, I think looking back on it now, you can see where the Trump phenomenon came from. But, you see, I always think that history is not an infallible guide to the future, but it's a useful pointer. And if you look at, for example, look at the other presidents who lost an election after a single term. Jimmy Carter. Did anybody think Jimmy Carter was going to come back 4 years later? No. George H.W. Bush Sr., he lost the election against Clinton. Did anybody look for him in 4 years' time to come back again and take on Clinton a second time? No, they didn't. Gerald Ford lost the election to Jimmy Carter. Did anybody want Gerald Ford to come back again in 4 years' time? No, they didn't. So the pattern of political life in America was very definitely that if you lose an election, you're dead. You're gone.
Except for Grover Cleveland.
Yeah, but that's the 19th century, a different kind of story.
1880s, yeah.
So the question is, how did Donald Trump manage to make this comeback and manage to win in 2024 after losing in 2020? He ought to have been out the door, especially after the events of the 6th of January. And I was in Washington that day, and I remember getting a call from someone I knew who was barricaded in a room with people outside screaming to get in, you know? So it was a dangerous time.
I'll take questions. Before I do, just very quickly, before we move on from the 2016 election, do you think Bernie Sanders would have beaten Trump?
No.
Okay.
Because, you see, I knew people who told me they voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary and voted for Donald Trump in the election. Yeah. So there were certainly people who could have gone for either, because both of them capitalized on the anti-establishment attitude. You know, they both were people who wanted to get at the elites, and therefore they appealed to the same kind of electorate. But unfortunately, Bernie wouldn't have kept the more cautious middle-class element of the Democratic support base. He would have lost that. So I think overall, I think Bernie would have done worse than Hillary.
So, quick question on the disaffected blue-collar workers across the Rust Belt, Chicago. So, I know a lot of people who would have been like really blue-collar Democrat voters in the 90s are now raging Trumpers. And that's all across middle America, right?
Yeah.
That all of those people, when they realize that Trump is not going to deliver for them, where are they going? Like, same with Brexit. When they realize that Brexit doesn't deliver in the UK, where do people go? So, like, it's obvious that Trump is not delivering for those blue-collar workers. He's just not, right?
Yeah.
So, where will they go? Where is this going? Yeah.
I mean, look, I mean, I'm here as a historian, as an observer of politics, as a former diplomat. I'm not here to take, you know, positions one way or the other. But I mean, yes, you're right that I mean, the point I would make to you is that the MAGA crowd, you know, their support for Trump is stronger than any political movement that I've come across in my lifetime, right? I mean, Richard Nixon didn't have a support base like the one that Donald Trump has. Ronald Reagan, who was the most popular president of that era, he didn't have a support base of that kind. Bill Clinton didn't have a support base. Even Barack Obama didn't have that kind of devoted support base. But Donald Trump has kept this support base now for more than nearly 10 years, right? And a lot of them are, they've made this decision that he's their man. And the great achievement for him is to convince these people that he's their representative, that he is the one that has their back and he cares about them. It doesn't matter whether he does or not. The fact is these people believe that. So, you know, I've always said that I don't rule out a populism of the left at some stage. You know, had Bernie Sanders been 20 years younger, and a bit more of a charismatic personality. I mean, Bernie is a fairly grumpy old guy, you know, and doesn't have a huge amount of charm. But if for example, Bernie Sanders had been looked more like Bill Clinton or more like Barack Obama, you could imagine someone like that in today's world becoming president. So I do think that politics has changed, and I think it's changed in Europe as well. And in a sense, you know, it may well change in Ireland too, because you know, America is a market leader. What happens in America today tends to influence what happens elsewhere in the world. We don't have much of a sense of what's happening in India or places that are far away, but we know about America. I was amazed by this, talking to people at home during my time in America. They knew as much about America as I did because they were watching CNN in the evening. I mean, the political nerds, you know? They watch CNN in the evening, so they're following American politics. So I do think there's a copycat effect here, and my question really would be, does the way Donald Trump has operated in this second term, does that change the political landscape forever? I mean, will future Democrat presidents behave in the same way and basically try to maximize executive power and essentially forget about the checks and balances in the Constitution put in there to strengthen the Congress and the judiciary? Both of those Donald Trump as president this time around has managed to circumvent to a large degree. The Congress has essentially given up on trying to keep him in check. And the judiciary has a mixed record, and we don't know yet whether the Supreme Court will ultimately go with him on some of the key things that are coming up. But I think that's a big question as to whether this is a game-changing presidency or not.
Dan, can you just hold that thought for a second?
Sure.
Just to bring in this chap here wants to come in with a question, and we'll come back to that, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of us here kind of understand the level of political disillusionment that exists in the United States. Yeah. We understand the level of economic deprivation that exists in, like, the Rust Belt and a lot of those places left behind. But I think, at least myself and a lot of other people, fundamentally struggle to put ourselves in the minds of the average swing voter or Trump voter in the States. So what is it that us lot here in Ireland just don't really get voter in the States?
Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately never got to a Trump rally because I was going to go to one in 2020 and then COVID came along and I just wasn't going to do that. But I did a podcast one day with a guy who's a CBS correspondent. His name is Major Major. He's actually called Major Major, believe it or not. And he's an interesting guy. And he's been around a long time. I said to him, look, I said, what can you tell me about the Trump rally? And he said, you see people there who've never believed in anything in their lives and who have bought into this guy and they believe him and they're not for turning. So there's something, I think he came along at the right time, at a time when people were ready for some kind of rebellion against the establishment, and he provided this avenue to those people, and he promised them, and they believe his promises, and even 10 years later, those promises are still largely believed. I mean, if you look at the Republican Party support for Donald Trump, it's still up in the 80s, heading for 90. So he hasn't lost very many of his loyal supporters. He may have lost people in the middle, independents, who actually decide elections in America, as they do in most countries when it comes down to it. So, yeah, he's managed to create this movement. And I remember Major telling me, he said, I used to watch these people coming in. And I'd watch them, and he said a lot of them were like, you know, you could see they hadn't got very successful lives. They weren't successful people. But he said they weren't at the bottom of the ladder either. They were people that had jobs and so on, but they were a bit maybe frustrated, a bit underwhelmed by their lives. I said you'd see their wives and girlfriends and partners with them, and you could see that the wives and girlfriends maybe weren't that wrapped up in Trump. They were a bit skeptical about him. But he said you could see them all changing during the event, because they saw their partners for the first time in their lives being enthusiastic about this guy, and therefore they became enthusiastic about him too. So there's a certain degree of a collective response to Trump, which I think is hard to explain, but I think it does explain the reason why he's managed to retain the support for nearly a decade now, despite all that's happened.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, do you think Trump will stop elections in America, that he'll carry on like Putin, that he wants to carry on?
Tell you, can I hold that question? Sure. Because I'm going to come to that in a minute. That's a good question.
Okay.
No, Dan, just you had gone in this area yourself. Now, is Trumpism now fully entrenched in U.S. society? Can we talk about? I mean, has he captured the state?
I'd say not the state, but he certainly captured a very substantial slice of the American public, the American election.
I mean, he's packed the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, but that's...
And Supreme Court's... I mean, the point is, that's not just the Supreme Court, but that's been happening in every state of the Union.
Yeah.
Right down to the dog catcher.
Yeah,
at the lowest level.
I mean, for example, the last gubernatorial election in Virginia was decided to a large degree by people on the education committees who were opposed to what the Democrats wanted to do in education, and went after the candidate Terry McAuliffe, a good Irish American, and Youngkin won instead. So local politics in America can be pretty fearsome, and I think it's true to say that the Democrats, I think when Obama won, there was an assumption that was a done deal, that America had now become a country that was controlled by the Obama coalition. And I think the Democrats took their eye off the ball, and they didn't pay enough attention to the local and the state elections. And it turned out that a lot of states went Republican and then started to change the rules for elections and do a bit of gerrymandering and so on. So I think that they did take their eye off the ball during the Obama period, believing that they had already achieved a situation which wouldn't change over time, but it did.
No, because, I mean, Obama was looking back on it, Obama was a massive disappointment. I mean, he could give a speech, right?
Yeah.
But he didn't do enough to change the lives of the people who voted for him, clearly.
You know, I've been thinking about this because, as a historian and History Ireland and all that, I've been looking back over the last century, and probably, apart from Roosevelt, who was in power for so long that, he did a huge amount in terms of dealing with the Depression and the New Deal and all that. But apart from that, I mean, the two most successful presidents, you could say, were Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson. And Truman had been a senator, so he understood how the Congress and Senate worked. He was an old hand there. He was still going, as a president, he would go across and play poker with the senators that he was friendly with when he was in the Senate. And then Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson was a master of the Senate for 10 years almost before he became president. And that stood to him. Whereas someone like Barack Obama had hardly been in the Senate for more than a few years. So he didn't have that. And actually, Kennedy had a relatively short spell in the Senate as well. So I do think that, you know, ability to manage American politics was always the gold standard. But of course, now you have a situation where all power is concentrated in the hands of a single person. Because when I was there in 2017 to 2022, Donald Trump was surrounded by people like John Kelly, General Jim Mattis, General John Kelly, Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of one of the big oil companies, right? You had Gary Cohen, you had Steve Mnuchin, you had people who were, I suppose, traditional Republicans who joined the Trump bandwagon, but were probably never fully of that bandwagon. Whereas now, the people involved in the second Trump administration are all people who are completely devoted to Donald Trump, and they're willing to facilitate Donald Trump's extension of the executive power of the presidency, which other presidents have tried to do, but they haven't always been successful. But this one is more successful because the resistance in Congress has largely evaporated, and the Supreme Court is quite indulgent now towards Donald Trump. Now, the big question is, if he did try to do something as dramatic as to cancel elections, would the Supreme Court stand with him on that? I don't believe it would. But the fact that you have to ask that question in itself is alarming.
I tell you, I've, many people want to ask questions. I just want to go back to the point John raised there from the floor. Because you seem to be saying that we are watching a change of state. This is a fundamental change, yeah, similar to FDR. Or you can look at various presidencies before that, right? Are we witnessing a creeping dictatorship, right? Because you've mentioned packing the Supreme Court. We've had the use or the abuse of the National Guard, supposedly on issues of law and order.
Yep.
And most worryingly, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. I mean, essentially, he has now mobilized his own army. These guys are armed. You get paid about $100,000 a year. That's double a teacher's salary. I mean, that just shows you where their priorities are. So, like, if something like the February the 6th thing happened again,
January
6th, it'd be guys in uniform, you know, who might be besieging the Capitol building.
Look, I spoke to a senior journalist during the week anticipating this question, right? And this journalist told me that she believed that while a lot of the guardrails in the American system had been dismantled, that there were still enough guardrails in place to ensure that President Trump couldn't go beyond a certain level, that he would be held back ultimately from doing something that would go beyond what people in America would regard as reasonable. And I would say that even somewhere like Poland, for example, where you had a kind of a populist government in for years and who were twisting the system in their favor, the Polish people surprised everyone by coming out in numbers and getting rid of that government.
Yeah.
So I do continue to believe in the ability of electorates to just get the outcome they want, regardless of the barriers you try to put in their way.
Yeah, but that's very difficult when the system is rigged, though. I mean, because the Electoral College, because the rural constituencies outweigh the urban ones, you know. I mean, it only takes the change of votes for about 50,000 people to decide an election. I mean,
the next election will again be decided in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina. About seven states will decide the election. So the people in those states are going to have huge power because those are the purple states. Those are the ones that can swing from one to the other. And if anyone who wins all seven of those states is going to win the presidency. So and the margins are very narrow. All those places are 1% or thereabouts, even less. So it doesn't take much for things to swing in the opposite direction. And the question is, if Donald Trump is not on the ballot in 2028, which I don't believe he will be, because I don't believe the Supreme Court would allow him to stand again for a third time, because I think that's in the Constitution. It would be very difficult for the Supreme Court, even a politically oriented Supreme Court, to overlook that element of the Constitution. But so I do think that, you know, when he's not on the ballot paper, I don't think whoever is representing the MAGA movement is going to have the same appeal as Donald Trump has to those people, many of whom are infrequent voters and simply won't come out to vote unless their man, Donald Trump, is on the ballot paper.
I was wondering if the victory of Zohra Mamdani in the recent primary in New York meant that the Democrats are obviously going to a more progressive side. I think that the Democratic base has really revolted against the leadership, especially Hakeem Jeffries and the others, and Chuck Schumer, who I believe will be primaried in the if AOC ran against her. I believe that I think that the Democrats are going more left. I think if they run a more populist, more affordable platform, I think that they will. I think the biggest mistake that Kamala Harris made when she ran in 2024 is that she didn't state what her issue on Palestine was. I think that really turned a lot of the college graduate base in Michigan against her, and that Michigan was one of the key states that she needed to win. So I think that if... I was wondering if you think that's realistic that a Democratic progressive could win in 2028.
I mean, it's not out of the question. And by the way, I agree with you. Her biggest failing was not to be able to say how she would be a different president from Joe Biden. That was a fatal error. She ought to have gone to Joe Biden and said, look, boss, I'm going to have to put a distance. It's nothing personal. I don't mean to be offensive towards you, but if I want to win this election, I'm going to have to disown part of your agenda, even though I was part of your team. I think Biden would have accepted that. He's an experienced pal. I think he would have gone along with that. The failure to do that was a really critical mistake on the part of the Harris campaign. Yeah, so I don't think that Zomdani, he's certainly a credible candidate in New York, but if he wins the mayorship in New York, that'll be used against the Democrats for the next 3 years to say this is the kind of person, and he's electable in New York.
Hiya. Just clearly you have such strong experience in the US and the UK, and Brexit kind of reignited this discussion around nationalism in the independent sense. It's technically a voluntary union. Do you think similar conversations could gain traction in the US with this current direction of travel with the Trump administration?
I don't think so. I think the US is a united country. Okay, it's divided politically and in other ways, economically, but I do think fundamentally there's this kind of respect for the flag, and there's the everyday kids, you know, proclaim their loyalty to the state. I don't think that's going to be overturned. I think in Britain and elsewhere in the world, you do have identities that are very different that have come together and can go apart. But I think in America, it's been a going concern for the last 250 years now. Okay, they had the Civil War, but I think that finished the temptation for America to divide again.
Thanks very much. I suppose following on from the previous speaker there, what's your opinion of the current state of the Democratic Party? Because in my view, they're just in the wind. They're all over the shop, and their messaging is off, and they're just seem to be kind of trying to attack Trump from democracy and stuff, whereas the real issues are affordability, childcare, the very bread and butter issues that Trump is actually profiting off.
No, look, I agree with you, and I agree with the last questioner as well. You know, the Democrats have done poorly. I mean, they were much more effective in 2017-18, and in fact, they won the House back in 2018. So they have, I think this time around, it just was more of a shock, because the first time, 2016, Trump was seen as an aberration and he was going to go away and, you know, America would go back to normal. But the second time around, after all that happened, they couldn't regard him as an aberration, and there's been far less resistance. Now, I'm told by my American friends that resistance is developing. And you see, the problem is that every party that loses an election like that, It spends a year or more stunned from the election loss, and it takes them a while to recover their equilibrium. So I think we will see from the end of this year, we'll start to see people, credible candidates for 2028 emerging, and they will become the new leadership of the Democratic Party. And I don't think it'll be Zomdani. I think it'll be, if I had to guess, I'd say someone like Andy Beshear, two-time governor of Kentucky. If you can win Kentucky twice, you can win America. Gretchen Whitmer, two-time governor of Michigan, Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, and then Wes Moore, governor of Maryland. These are all up-and-coming Democrats who are pretty smart. Gavin Newsom's obviously going to be in the picture as well. He's decided to take on Trump in a kind of his own particular way. Then you have J.B. Pritzker, who's a pretty tough political operator as well, and he's also on the prowl. So there's a lot of people out there with talent. We don't know which of those people is going to come through at this stage. I mean, if you look at it, 3 years before the election that Bill Clinton won, did anybody know about Bill Clinton? 3 years before Carter won, nobody knew about Jimmy Carter. 3 years before Donald Trump won in 2016, nobody would have imagined Donald Trump would be. So a new wind will start to blow through America. And I think it'll be a kind of a center-left wind rather than an arch-progressive wind. But I think it's going to be a more progressive candidate this time than either Biden or Clinton was.
Yeah, hiya. You mentioned earlier about the elites. So when people talk about the elites of the world, and when you were saying that there were people that wanted to beat the elites, yeah. So see now, you think that maybe Trump is with the elites, and maybe who is the elites, and is it really real? Is it him just being the face and people pulling the puppet strings behind?
No. I honestly think he's in control, right? Is he fully in control? Well, nobody's ever fully in control of anything. And he does have, but the people around him these days are extremely loyal. I don't think any of them will challenge him. Like, John Kelly was a tough Marine general. John Kelly was quite conservative, but he was a traditional conservative. He's broken with Trump since then. I think Kelly would have said to Trump, sorry, you can't do this. You can't do this. I don't think anybody in the current Trump orbit will be saying to the president, you can't do this. So he's now following his own instincts, and he's not being curbed by people around him, pulling him back and saying, no, that won't work. He's now realized that he can make things work because he can do things and get away with them. And he's shown over the last 8 months that he can make his own weather. He can actually do things, and the Congress won't stop him, and the courts may stop him, but they don't do it all the time, and eventually he'll probably get his way with the courts as well. So he's in a very strong position. And the question is, politicians having learned that you can do this kind of thing, will any of them unlearn that lesson? Can you put that genie back into the bottle? I'm not so sure you can. No, I mean, again, reading about the history of the American presidency, you see that many presidents were frustrated by Congress and the judiciary. Sure, FDR tried to pack the Supreme Court, and he was stopped by Congress. Woodrow Wilson had contempt for Congress. He believed he knew everything. So Teddy Roosevelt wasn't very happy about Congress either. So it's always been a tradition in America that the president is a kind of an elected king. But presidents until now have taken on a restraint that maybe on the basis of the experience of the last 8 months, they didn't need to take on. Maybe they could have extended the remit of their power beyond what they thought was possible. So Trump, I think, has pushed out the boundaries of what was thought to be possible and impossible regarding the deployment of executive power. And that's an extraordinary achievement. And it's been done because of the loyalty of the people that are part of that MAGA movement. With that loyalty, you could do anything. Because I knew Republicans, senators and congresspeople who said, I don't care for Trump's policies, but I can't oppose him because my electorate are 100% behind him. And the first question I'm asked at my town hall meeting is, are you supporting our president? So, you know, politicians on the Republican side are caught in the bind. Now, I think when we start coming towards the midterm elections, I think there'll be more willingness on the part of Republicans to put a distance between themselves and Donald Trump if he starts to become a little less popular, if his numbers drop, if inflation takes off and he starts to leak water, then I think you will see people finding ways of trying to put a little bit of a distance between themselves and Donald Trump. But until now, he has enjoyed such loyalty that he hasn't had to restrain himself in any way from following his own instincts regarding what a president should do.
Compared to 2016, how do you think like the rise of Gen Z voters and social media impacted the last election, or if any?
Social media? Yeah. No, I mean, social media has changed the world of politics, because everyone can now have a view on everything. And I mean, I'm on social media. I'm on X at Dan Mulhall, if you want to follow me, but I have 37,000 followers, so a reasonable following for someone like me. But I don't get much abuse because, you know, I'm not an elected politician, so no one goes after me very much. But if you go into any politician's social media account, and it's shocking, even the most benign political figures, they get the most appalling abuse. So that's just become the way of life these days. And I personally wouldn't recommend my children or grandchildren to go into politics in the current climate, because it's a very nasty world now. And everything that you've ever said since the era of video recordings, if you go for election, it's going to come back and hit you. And you have to explain all sorts of things that you said years ago. I wouldn't want to have to explain things I said as a student, by the way. Would you? But now you have to, because it's probably going to be there on the record somewhere, and someone's going to hold it against you if you stand for election. So, yeah, the world has changed. Social media has kind of poisoned the whole environment when it comes to democratic politics, and it's why we have these populist movements taking root everywhere in the world now, everywhere in the democratic world.
Dan, just to bring in something else, do you think there's a supreme irony in that Donald Trump is the most interventionist, statist president of the United States we've had, which is totally different from the free marketeers of classical republicanism, you know, old-style republicanism? Because we had been fed the illusion that the market kind of just operates, you know, by the laws of nature or something, right? And the states can't intervene. But Donald Trump has proven it can intervene. So, I mean, negatively, in my opinion, but it proves the state could intervene in a positive way in if it was taken up in a left-wing direction.
Well, look, I mean, obviously, not in America, but in Britain, for example, the Labour government under Attlee and Wilson, they intervened. They, you know, nationalised a lot of industries, and then they were privatised under Thatcher. So in the past, this sort of government ownership of the means of production hasn't worked out very well. And isn't it extraordinary to think that Donald Trump criticised the CEO of Intel, then called him in for a meeting, and ended up pocketing 10% of Intel's shares? I mean, I don't remember that happening in the past. And I think if it had happened under Joe Biden, it would have been called something akin to communism, you know? And yet, the Republican Party seems to be willing to stand over that. Also, you know, the independence of the Federal Reserve Board, that would have been regarded as an absolute principle that couldn't be breached by any Republican. And yet, we now have a director of the board being fired. She's taking legal action. Maybe the courts will, you know, will keep her in her place. You have the president openly calling on Jerome Powell to resign and calling him all kinds of names. And yet the markets seem to be remarkably unaffected by all of this. I mean, you get these ups and downs, but ultimately the markets are still more or less where they were when Trump came into office in January. So all of this chaos has not really dented American economic confidence. I think, you know, so my feeling is that America, you know, will probably come through this thing regardless economically, because America has strengths that no amount of chaos can undermine.
You may have just answered my question. I'm an American, not a Trump supporter. A question for you is, do you have hope for America?
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, I know so many great Americans. I mean, look, I had the privilege, after I retired in 2022, of teaching at two American universities, right? I taught at NYU and Harvard. And I mean, my students there were exceptional people, right? So if you have exceptional people like that, I think the country will find its way through this current morass. So I'd be very optimistic about Ireland, about Europe, and about America. You know, there are huge issues, of course. You know, the global economy is changing fundamentally. China has become a force that nobody can ignore. And it's changing the, you know, the rules of the game. And it may change them even more. Russia has become much more aggressive in Europe. But I still think that the democracies will muddle through. And I include in that America muddling through despite the difficulties that have currently arisen there.
No, just
so I'm optimistic about America. It's a glass half full, okay? At least half full.
Now, I'm just looking at the time here because I want to move on to the implications for Ireland, because Donald Trump is a man who promoted a civilly convicted rapist to be president of Ireland. I'm not even going into the whole thing of the tariffs, right? That's another question. But he's also undermined the Good Friday Agreement by imposing different tariffs on the European Union, i.e. Ireland, and the United Kingdom. I mean, part of the whole thing of the Good Friday Agreement was the creation of an all-island economy and so on, and he shot it under the water.
Look, I mean, on the Conor McGregor thing, I wouldn't take that too seriously. I mean, as far as Donald Trump is concerned, McGregor is a sort of a celebrity in his world because he's a fan of that, you know, mixed martial arts business. So he would have seen McGregor as just a guy that, you know, and I mean, I don't think Trump's advisors were going to block him from inviting Conor McGregor into the White House. So I give him a pass on that one. I don't think he would have been, I don't think that would have been seen as a slap in the face from Micheál Martin. And people made a big thing about, oh, McGregor was there on Patrick's Day and Micheál Martin was there the previous week. That was our choice because we always look for that meeting in a week when the Congress is sitting, because you then get the president, the vice president, and the Congress in the same week. If you go there in a week like Patrick's Day this year when the Congress was not sitting, all the Congress people are scattered to the four winds. There's nobody in Washington. Washington is like a ghost town in those weeks when Congress is not sitting. So that would have been our choice. So, I mean, look, Donald Trump has a positive attitude to Ireland for the simple reason that he owns a golf course down in County Clare. And what's more, he told me he had good experiences in developing that course when he acquired it and so on. And he has good, positive vibes about Ireland from that point of view. Yes, I think it's unfortunate that the tariff rate for the EU is higher than the tariff rate for the UK. Because, for example, if you're a producer of Irish whiskey in Kerry, you have now a 15% tariff on your product, whereas Bushmills from Northern Ireland has 10%. So it's a 5% gap. If I were the Irish government, I would ultimately try to go to Trump and say, could you not apply the same tariff just to Irish whiskey across the board, whether it's
15% for the whole island then?
Sorry?
So 15% for the whole island.
10% for the whole island.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, the point is that I do think that we've been lucky so far that he hasn't come after Ireland, right? Because Donald Trump judges what the tariffs should be on each country by the scale of that country's trade surplus in goods with the United States. Our trade surplus is way above the European average. So if he was treating us individually, we'd probably be facing a tariff of 35-40%. We're lucky to be part of the European Union because overall he decided 15% was the right tariff for the EU and the EU accepted. Now, if I were the EU, I would have held out. I think I would have tested to see whether he really would be willing to go into a trade war with the European Union. But the EU decided to back down and accept 15% as better than 30% and better than a trade war. And that's fine. But I would have made a different calculation, to be honest with you.
Okay, Dan, just to finish up, just by the way, does anyone else want to ask any questions here? No, I just want to finish up with this one, right? Because the UK claims to have a special relationship with the United States, but we claim to have a unique relationship with the United States and said to be based on...
Uniquely special.
Yeah, common ancestral ties, and that'll never change.
I think I wrote this speech myself, actually.
and shared values.
Oh, yep, that's us.
But that's hardly still the case, Dan, is it? I mean, well, we have what I would call a kind of a modest social democracy, very modest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which in the MAGA discourse is described as communist.
Yeah, I know.
If you read the stuff.
Yeah.
So you're talking chalk and cheese here. So, I mean, does that not present us with a problem?
Look, America is a divided society. And you have people on both sides of the fence, MAGA or non-MAGA, who have very different views. So look, I don't worry too much about that because, you know, after the midterms next year, America could be a very different country because the historical pattern, as you know, is that every single time the last 100 plus years, the party that's not in the White House gains 15, 20 seats in the midterms. And that means Democrats very likely, not certain, but very likely to control the House. And from then on, the checks and balances really change completely. And I think a lot of Democrats would have similar views to what Ireland's views would be in terms of the values agenda. So I'm not too worried about that. That's a transient thing. Irish America is a powerful thing. When I went to America in 2017, everyone told me that I would discover Irish America to be a waning resource. In fact, I found the opposite. I found that there were people I met who were four or five generations removed from Ireland and who still felt a passionate connection with our country. See, I mean, I'll just give you one example. Just before COVID, my last event before COVID, I was out speaking at a gathering hosted by an organization with a wonderful title, the Emerald Society of the Tidewater, out near Norfolk, Virginia, out on the sea there. Beautiful part of America where the first settlers came in, Williamsburg's out there and Jamestown and all of that. And I was met by the president of a society. She had a German name, but obviously had Irish background. But her Irish background was like four or five generations back. I got into her car. She picked me up to take me to the function. And from the mirror onto her dashboard was dangling her National Library of Ireland card. And I said, "What's that there for?" She said, "I'm not entitled to a passport, and this is the only official Irish document I can have to demonstrate my Irish identity." And I thought, isn't that fantastic? And at the same event, I met a woman who told me that her mother, who was six generations in America, went back and made contact with their 10th cousins in County Leitrim or wherever it was. Obviously, they're building the new ballroom in the White House. and she told me her mother was now buried in the local church where her family had come from in the 19th century. So we don't realize this, but for Americans, where your ancestors come from is important because they all come from somewhere. I don't know where anybody beyond my great-grandparents came from. But a lot of Americans can tell you where their great-great-great-great-grandparents came from because genealogy is important because it's an immigrant society. I remember Joe Kennedy III, who is Bobby Kennedy's grandson. I mean, Joe is probably sixth generation. He once told me, "Dan, anything you need, give me a call." Right? So there's still that connection. Even though we kind of sometimes neglect it, because Irish people get a bit antsy when someone says, "I'm Irish." When Joe Biden says, "I'm Irish," he doesn't believe he was born in Ireland. Of course not. That'd be ridiculous. What he means is, "I'm an Irish American." Being an Irish American is an American identity, but it's one that's connected to Ireland, and it's very valuable for Ireland. And we should hang on to that connection for as long as we possibly can. I saw enough evidence of the continuing power of that identity to make me believe that it still has a bit of life in it yet. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Tommy, for inviting me to be here. Making your debut at a rock festival at my age is quite something. Thank you very much. Got to meet him, Malcolm Galair.
And thank you very much for coming along, especially this early, and especially those people who make contributions from the floor. Very high quality, I have to say.
Very good.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent.